Blog Talk Radio. Good evening, Alafia, and welcome to Care to Read. I'm glad you decided to join us this evening, and we definitely have a show for you this evening. We're looking forward to talking to you about our subject, and as you know, as from yesterday, we started out talking about health education, focusing in on curriculum in the classroom, what can be done to change the curriculum so that it is more suited and fit for the African-American students. We went over curriculums and talked about the possibility for reexamining, looking at changing the curriculum so that it is more African-centered and focused. Now, once again, as always and as is, we always ask for permission from our elders before we speak, and I'm going to ask Terrell to come and purify me. Terrell, will you please purify me? Thank you very much. And ladies and gentlemen, as I get cleaned up for this ritual, as is as always, we know that the journey to freedom is a quite long one for the African Americans, but we like to mark that occasion. African Americans have been so important in the lives of shaping this country that we have to take a noted day out in February to acknowledge them, but I'd like for you to begin to start to take days out of your schedule on a day-to-day basis to call these saints, if you would call them, or ancestors. Call them out by name periodically and acknowledge them. And that's what I'm about to do right now. As we know, throughout history, we had entertainers, we had entrepreneurs, there were as well our sports people. We had a variety of teachers that we want to remember and keep them in our cosmic records. So therefore, we do this ritual in honor of the Africans to keep their names alive. And you know it is up to the living to stay in touch with the dead. And in doing this ritual, I set a pace for the African families to follow after me and to implement this program within their homes. As an African priestess and trained, I am obligated to make sure that my community is informed about the traditions of Africans and the way that we are to carry out our lives. And as I begin to get cleaned up for this occasion, I am going to pause for a second to get ready to go on with the ceremony and just pause for a brief second, and we'll be right back at you in the air. Once again, that call number is 646-478-0270, and we'll be right back at you in the air. And thanks for joining us.
A Scar, read by the author Sherelle Omiika Garth. A Scar is sexism, classism, ageism, and racism. A Scar is isms that hold us back, creating a deficiency and a lack. A scar is visible, but mostly unseen to the eyes of the average human being. They deter us from reaching our dreams. A scar can come in different sexes, and sometimes they can appear in the heterosexuals. A scar comes in classes they come to suppress and even try to undermine the masses. A scar can come in all ages, and sometimes they don't develop to their full stages. A scar comes in all faces. They can show up in unfamiliar places, and you can even find them hiding amongst the races.
Once again, we're back, and thank you for joining us and being a part of this ritual. As we begin to prepare for this ritual, I'd like to say that this ritual, and we look at the right of us, and we look to the left, and we call our ancestors, and we ask our ancestors to be present here with us today. And I ask permission from the elders to speak. Do I have permission from the elders to speak? And they give me the nod, saying to go ahead and to make sure I acknowledge my deities as well. I invite my deities, Obatala, and also Yamanja, my mother's spirit and my father's spirit. And as I began to prepare for this ritual, I asked that you would just basically, by joining in, saying Ashe, as I call out our ancestors' names. And we want to call them so that they are present here with us today. So I am going to summon our ancestors, and then the correct way would be to ring a bell, and the bell is rung periodically to summon those ancestors to come forward. And as they come forward, we welcome them, and we say welcome, and we say thank you. Ashe, Ashe. I'd like to call out those names to you of the ancestors that have gone on before us, those that may be on their way here and not be knowing to us any names that we may not know of, and those unborn, yet unborn ancestors. And as I call their names out, I'd like to call out Booker T. Washington, and we say Ashe. I say Banneker. I say Benjamin Banneker. Ashe. And I'm going to ask my co-host if he will assist me as we say Ashe in the audience. And then I call out the name of Coretta Scott King. Ashe.
Ashe.
Martin Luther King. Ashe.
Ashe.
Frederick Douglass. Ashe. George Washington Carver. Ashe. Harriet Tubman. Ashe. Jackie Robinson. Ashe.
Ashe.
Langston Hughes. Ashe. Leanne King Price. Ashe. Louis Armstrong. Ashe. Malcolm X. Ashe. Madam C.J. Walker. Ashe. Marian Anderson. Ashe. Muhammad. Well,
Ashe.
Excuse me. Rosa Parks. Ashe. Dr. Clark. Ashe. Dr. Carruthers. Ashe. W.E.B. Du Bois. Ashe. And Zora Neale Hurston. Ashe. Now, those are our heroes and sheroes, ladies and gentlemen. But I'd like to call out my personal ancestors' names. Robert Jenkins. Ashe. My father. My mother. Clara Mae Jenkins, Ashe. Tommy Pete Harvey, Ashe. Mary Lou Hawkins, Ashe. Marvin Jenkins, Ashe. Robert Jr. Jenkins, Ashe. Michelle Harvey, Ashe. Sam Lilly, Ashe. George Lilly Ashe. And I call out my deities again, Obatala, the Father Spirit Ashe, and Yamenja, the Mother Spirit Ashe. May they be pleased with us today, as it is up to the living to stay in contact with the dead. And we thank you, ancestors, for being present here with us today, because there was a time that we were molested for coming together and speaking of anything such as ancestors. But we are thankful that we are able to assemble ourselves together to acknowledge you unmolested or unharmed. And we thank you, ancestors, that you've covered the ground for us, that you've allowed protection to go forth for us. You've covered each household who's represented here today in your protection, because we know it is important that we ask for sanctuary, and we're asking the ancestors to give us sanctuary. It is very important that we not go on our way thinking it is in our own strength, because we know we can do nothing in our own strength. And you know, as always, we always do the flag, and the colors of the flag are red, green, and black. And it's important for African Americans to have affirmation and ritual. Here's to the flag of mine, the red, black, and green. Hopes to its future bright, Africa has seen. Here's to the red of it. Great nations shall know of it in time to come. Red blood shall flow of it. Historians shall write of it. Great flag of mine. Here's to the flag of it. here's to the black of it, or 100 million back of it, whose destiny depend on it, the red, black, and green of it, old flag of mine. Here's to the green of it, young men shall dream of it, face shot and shelled of it, maidens shall sing of it, waving so high. Here's to the whole of it, colors brought and told of it, pleased is my soul with it, regardless of what is told of it, thanks to God for getting it, great flag of mine. Ladies and gentlemen, teach your children traditional heritage. Let them know that the African Americans do acknowledge a flag that comes out of Africa that flies under the colors of red, black, and green. It is important that we learn our language. And as I told you earlier, we must learn the Yoruba language. We must learn to speak some of the prayers in the language of the Yoruba. We must learn that. And the reason why is because the prayers were given in the language of Yoruba, and it's important that we learn those stories and tell our children. It is very important. In fact, it is a requirement and an obligation for the African Americans to learn their own history, not someone else's history, ladies and gentlemen. Failure to do so will force entire generations of African Americans to become desperate, to live in a generation after generation in a total darkness, ignorance, which will destroy their entire race. If blacks depend on the Caucasian race to educate their children, then they are guaranteed for doom. We are not going to have anyone teach us our heritage any better than we can do it. That is why I'm taking the time to do this now. Blacks must educate their own, just as we must educate our young children and make sure that they know the national anthem. This is a power education for young camp and teachers for young camp. We must also educate our children. And I'd like to say, Ashe, Ashe, so let it be done, so let it be. I'd like to thank you for participating in our ritual this afternoon and being a part of a tradition that must be implemented in action also to the African American family. I am whole and I am free, ladies and gentlemen, and I want every African to know that freedom comes with a price. It is important that you continue to let your heritage stay alive. We'd like to thank you for being a part of this ritual, and let's dream of Africa. Ladies and gentlemen, we have our guest in the audience. I see that she's out there now. We'd like to welcome her. Our guest is in the audience. I see her hand up out there. Thank you. And I'd like to welcome her. Welcome. Can you hear me? This is Lavita. Sister Lavita.
This is Sister Latavia. Yes, I'm here.
Sister Latavia. Am I pronouncing your name right, Sister? Okay, Sister Latavia from the HER, Latavia from the HER organization. She is here from Indianapolis, Indiana. And my guest, my co-host, is going to be introducing her. We'd like to say welcome to you. Co-host, are you there?
Yes. Hello.
Good evening.
Hello, my name is Terrell Garf, and I would like to welcome you to Care to Read. I would also like to welcome our guest, Sister Latavia from HER organization. Welcome, Sister Latavia.
Thank you so very much.
Thank you. We're going to have Mrs. Latavia come up, and we're going to put her right in the air. Sister Latavia, we do have questions that we'd like to ask you, and the topic of our show this evening, so that you'll know what the topic of discussion is, we have been talking about health education and curriculum and changing of curriculum in the classroom for African-American children. And today's topic is talking about what are the five dimensions of consciousness and what is the relationship between culture, consciousness, and what should the relationship of an African-American male and female be, such as, you know, how must that relationship be implemented in the classroom or in relationship, and what are the African-American men and women generally go, how do they form relationships, and why is it always said that African-American males are against the females? And we want to set the record straight that African-American males have always been friends, and the males are females' best buddies, and we have no known hidden agenda against our black brothers, and that cliche that was put out there is another one of the Willie Lynch theories to conquer and divide, and we want to set that misnomer to rest today by talking about the classroom environment and what relationships should look like on the campuses, school, on the university campuses, in the classroom, and in the home, and how can we better design curriculums that will fit to meet the needs of our black children so that they are not stagnant and distorted with information that they get from books that are not designed to help the African-American's relationship or help the family to develop. So I'm going to bring Sister Latavia in the atmosphere. Sister Latavia, you have the atmosphere, and I'd like to tell those listening audience, please do call in, and our number here is 646-478-0270. Sister Latavia, you're in the air.
Thank you very much. Now, initially, if I'm understanding correctly, you'd like me to speak into what you just described to me, correct?
Sister Latavia, if you could tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got started with the homeschool. Sister Latavia has been involved with homeschooling. She also has a campus that her and several other families work on. I'd like her to talk a little bit about telling us how she got started, what drove her to start teaching the children at home, and the program she offers on the campus. How is that faring, and how many families are currently living there now? And then you can delve into the topic, you know, when you see fit.
Well, I'm one of the administrators for Her Living Campus here in Indianapolis, as you stated. HER stands for Honor, Educate, and Restore. We are a matriarchal environment where we deal with sustainability and self-sufficiency. And many people mistakenly assume that because we're matriarchal, there are no men involved, and that's far from true. We believe in gender balance and not gender bias. I've been a homeschool educator for about 22 years now. I've homeschooled for 20 years in dealing with children as well as my own children, other people's children, collectively. And the way I became involved in that process was just being convinced through a public education system that I felt failed to prepare me for true adulthood, true further education, that when I decided to become a mother, I started looking into how I could go about providing a better education for my children. When I struck out to discover ways to do that, ultimately what started happening was I was homeschooling without really designing a curriculum to homeschool in the sense that I knew there was so much more my children could learn if they were challenged, stimulated properly, and if they were safeguarded from some of the negative stimulation that they would have encountered in a public school setting. That's how we began homeschooling, dealing with other children the way our collective basically started forming, where we developed a homeschool cooperative, is because there was such a contrast between the educational results in my biological children and some of their immediate peers in the quote-unquote conscious community, that we developed sort of a trade-off. We started sharing the responsibility of homeschooling formally. That homeschool co-op that I assisted in founding later went on to become one of the very prestigious Muhammad universities. There's one that runs here in Indianapolis. There are a few of them in the country. And so that school is still in operation today. I've gone on and became part of the foundation for Her Living Campus, and I've been here for 6 years, and I've continued the homeschooling cooperative as well. And the reasons are very much so.
I had a, had a question. When you said that you knew that there was much, much more that your children could be challenged on, would you then say that that the schools in Indianapolis then were experiencing some type of crisis where they were not able to teach because of the disruptive conditions of the classroom?
No, I would not have said that then, and I, oddly enough, wouldn't say that now. What I meant by that, what my position was at the time was that there was not a, a genuine desire to teach children to become what I desired for my children to become, which were free thinkers, analytical thinkers, driven and inspired towards liberation and true freedom, not just for themselves, for their families, for their communities, humanitarians, not just obedient citizens. So it wasn't so much that there was such disruption in public school. I made these decisions for my children when they were much younger than technically school age. I just knew they were brilliant infants, and they could go so far if only they had been given the environment and opportunity to do so, and I knew public education was not it. I also
You're absolutely right, Sister Batavia, because what I had experienced firsthand, and I was in those classrooms, so, you know, as looking at it from both sides of the spectrum, seeing that I was behind the desk and had the responsibility of carrying out that death sentence for the children at times, I found that for black children, the curriculum was not a critical one that would allow them to process. Most of the time it was rote learning, and I needed to see children process. I needed to see them figure things out, to use their cleverness and their street smarts that they brought from home. And we created a micro school, and within the classroom, I was asked to come in and fix schools, and I had, you know, wasn't really sure if I wanted to come back in the classrooms, but after coming back from overseas and going into classrooms and seeing that it really needed some help, I was asked to come in and set up some kindergarten programs and fix some classrooms. So they gave me the leverage right there, and otherwise I would have had to stick strictly to the curriculum. But in coming into the classroom, I saw that the children needed more opportunity to be challenged, just like you did. And we created a macro school, and you have the macro universe and you have the micro. So we created a micro, and we were allowed to do all our academics before noon, and then by the time noontime rolled around, they were able to put on their work clothes and go to work. And we created a society where they could actually go to become employed, and they held positions. And this whole concept, it is not one that I created, but it was one that was out there. And the children that were coming from the inner city were used to getting paid. When they came to school, they were used to money being very, very high. You could not use the barter system with the African-American child. They were so bright and intelligent. They knew that money was what had value. Anytime you gave a little ticket or a little smiley face, it meant nothing to them. So we went out and created our own money so they could have their own money, and I told them that that money could be cashed in for real items and material things. Then I had them. I mean, I had, at that particular point, I owned them because I could get them to learn anything I wanted because they wanted in on this thing where they would actually be employed. So I found that that was a ticket to get them to actually use their brain. Most of the African-American children were skating through, and they were not being challenged, so they act out. Whenever you see a child acting out, and they're brilliant is because they're not being challenged. Then you find the teachers want to put a lot of work on them instead of using their skill to do the things that they want to learn about school. So what you're saying is so true about taking a child home to teach them. I took my two sons home and taught them as well, and I work with families in the community to set up their own home schools. And I'm a teacher, and people say, how could you do that? You're going against the public school. No, I wasn't. I was trying to save some children before they got into the cesspool and end up going down and drowning. So I hear exactly what you're saying. Now, can you tell me, Sister Batavia, when you did the homeschooling, what made you decide to have a campus? Was this for the older children, or was the campus more for the family?
No. The campus itself is for the purpose of full sensory learning, and it's for the entire family from cradle to grave. We at one time housed an elder who recently passed not long ago, and another thing that we do is with full sensory learning is understand that self-sufficiency and sustainability requires self-improvement, so we deal with a lot of adults self-improvement courses as well. We're learning to be better adults, better parents, self-reliant, African-minded.
Now, let me ask you, when you say self-reliance, sister, now that term for a lot of African-Americans, sustainability, it means dealing with changing a light bulb. It means going green. It means, recycling. It also means to get in touch with nature and keep nature clean. But sustainability is also self-reliance. I'm a home ec teacher, Sister Batavia, and all that you're talking about is family, working on self-reliance and utilizing the home life to have an extended family. And that's where I think school is failing. They have not connected the families with the school. When they drop the child off, they lock the doors and say they don't want the parent in the class. But because I was a home ec major, I knew the value of bringing the family in and creating a parenting program for them. And that is probably the $1,000 question. If we wanted to fix schools, what would be the necessary entity? I would say putting the families in there and connecting them because we no longer have a community. So would this be, Sister Batavia, like reconnecting the families and creating that community that we no longer have? Extended family in a community?
Reconnecting the families is for the sake of returning to the concept of it taking a village. It doesn't just take a village to rear a child. It takes a village to get through life. When it comes to families and education, that is your first school setting. Your family is your educational center. It is your academic learning facility. Because you learn everything about relationships, values, principles, character, social acceptability, appropriatenesses, dignity. You learn all the things that are necessary to function within the collective, within the broader society. You learn that from within a family. You mentioned earlier one of the programs you did with some of the students in your micro school was to give them basically a currency base, something that had value, that they knew to have value. And one of the phrases you used that you had them, once they realized they could exchange these tickets or these tokens or this money, per se, it was a medium of exchange for things that they valued, real tangible things. Understand.
Absolutely.
That is what goes on. The same way you want to use that process to heal your people, that is the exact same process used to kill your people.
Let me clarify what I was saying in that, Sister Batavia, because, see, Let me try to clarify what I was saying. What I was saying is that the children, they come to you, they have their eyes are what we're taught to look at their eyes to see their lives, their eyes spark up or they lighten up, and what moves them or what changes them. So as I begin to see the light bulbs come on in their eye when they say, oh, we can come to school and get paid a dollar. We have a store we can go to and get real things. I begin to see the light bulbs come on, and meaning that I got them, meant now I know what turns them on, so to speak.
Yes, I gathered that. I gathered that was your meaning. But I'm also saying that that's the process that it took to really capture their attention, to really capture their occupation with what you're engaging them in. I gather that. A lot of times parents are looking for answers to a system that they believe is broken. And what I'm trying to help to convey to your listeners is the system is not broken. It's functioning the way it is designed to function.
Well, absolutely.
Like you're absolutely right. It takes teachers like you to come in and change the outcome. But for the most part,
it is not broken, Sister Latavia. You absolutely make it a good point. It is not broken. It is, you have to know the curriculum. It is a white male self-esteem curriculum. It is designed to do what it do. It acknowledges European ancestors and reinforce their concepts, and it was designed for white males. Curriculums were not designed for females, black or white. I'm a curriculum major, and one of the first things they taught us is that this curriculum has not been designed for females, and nor has it been designed for African Americans. It was designed for those white males in power. So the curriculum being up under the Jewish instruction, it has not been changed. And there has not been enough African-Americans who have a curriculum background to say, isn't it time that we reexamine this curriculum to see if it is fit to be implemented for African-American children? I said that, and I did make a note of it, and I said it in a way that in writing my thesis paper, I had ventured out to write a curriculum, which I have put a curriculum together, which is in the Garth approach that works on African-centered education along with Montessori inclusive. At the same time, most of your administrators who are not trained in curriculum, they don't know enough about the curriculum to know that this curriculum has been endorsed for Eurocentric children and that there's enough material now that we could incorporate an infusion program and make a difference. It's doing what it's supposed to do, but it's the wrong children that we're implementing it to.
And as a result, it's designed to have a sifter effect, meaning any of the children who it's not designed to assist, it is designed to debilitate. It's designed
Absolutely.
To make your children either hostile or docile. But you're going to leave that system one way or another. And either product, hostile or docile, ends up working for the very oppressor who continues to churn and crank the very machine that is
And what we like to say, Sister Latavia, we talk about children who are being overassessed for having this extra adrenaline. Now, whenever you put a person in a fearful situation, they become flight or fright. They back up against the wall either to attack you or to run out as fast as they can. And most of our children are going through something call a psychological rearrangement. And what is happening, either they are either dropping out or they are falling through the cracks, and some are even being pushed out because they're finding that the very systemics of the curriculum, it actually causes them to have to be in a confrontation situation. And believe it or not, when we're told up front, You will go in and you will assess these children and you will look for children that might have a deficit. And I'd like for you, by law, you have to identify these children. You have to tell us and you have to write their names down, make referrals, and then we send the special ed team in. And then at that point, we make a decision if that child needs to be labeled. Now, this is not a random thing. This is a mandatory thing. Now, if you're constantly looking for the bad apple in the group, trying to find those bad apples because there is money attached to them and that there's increase of administrative finances attached to this, you're going to find most teachers spending their days doing assessments and writing reports, going in and out of meetings, trying to separate those children and getting them into those classes where they're remediated. Now, what I say is that if you reevaluate the curriculum, you wouldn't have to do all that because every child has a deficit nowadays, and they don't necessarily have to be a child suited for special ed. They could come in, and by virtue of their address, where they were born and the mother's age when they were born, it would make those children a high-risk child. So when you come into a situation, you have an absolutely intelligent young lady, but because her mother had her when she was 18, she's now at risk. So you got all of these children in the same cesspool with the special needs children who need the remediation, who may be crack cocaine children, and then another child may be in that group because of her mother living on the other side of the tracks. Now she is also being assessed for special needs. So what you have is an all-time problem where most of your children are being assessed for a unique special needs. Now, this is how bad it's gotten. We've got some schools that are set up where they have the lower-level basement school for those children who may be blemished or flawed that cannot come out in the general public. So they go to something they call the underworld, and they are remediated until they are fit to come upstairs so that they're visible and that their test scores are incorporated with the general public or population. In the meantime, they're being remediated. Now, that's a great concept so that you don't get all those kids mixed together. It's a great concept, and it might be one that we need to adapt in all schools because you have some children that are so disrupted they cannot be a part of the general population for the fear of you not being able to carry out the lesson. So we've got a lot of things.
You have to understand why they're being disruptive. You have to be very crystal clear why they're being disruptive, because these children are stimulated and sorted from Head Start age. This isn't something, the disruption it's not even a side effect, it's a symptom. It's a symptom of stimuli that has occurred with that student for the past 5 years. So by the time a child is in fourth grade, you've got this seemingly out of control student.
And I think we call that the fourth grade syndrome.
I'm not familiar with that particular title, but I am familiar with fourth grade being the age when it makes a break. So you can identify which particularly black male children you're going to lose by age 16.
Dr. Duke spoke about that, and he called it the fourth grade failure syndrome, and that's where the curriculum turns from the right side of the brain to a more logical left side, and then that's when the child starts to show it demonstrates the failure syndrome.
Well, they've been stimulated a certain way from the age of 3 years old. Children are placed in nationwide Head Start programs. That's your first culprit. They're taken out of the home. To qualify for the program, the moms are usually stay-at-home moms because they're receiving some subsidy. They qualify for this quote-unquote free education. You have to look at the fact that in this very country, you have a lower percentage of people in this country who can actually read now than you did before public education was made freely available. You had a greater percentage of literacy before you had public school. So when you take children at 3 years old who should still be with their families, and you put them into a Head Start program, and it's called a program for a reason, and you start indoctrinating them with this foreign science, this foreign social setup, this foreign social science. It's like a lab. And you keep indoctrinating, and they're constantly running these little tests. They're these little frivolous psychological tests and assessments and examinations. By the time this child is in fourth grade, they've already been determined where they're going to fit in the sector. So you have states
now,
like
that
Indiana.
That is one of the concepts, true enough, sister, but there's also other concepts. Now, when they looked at that concept, I don't know if you're familiar with the Ypsilanti study, where they did that study to show that those children that they tracked that went to early Head Start, mm-hmm. and they tracked them over periods of time, they showed that those children were more successful and that they did graduate and go on to college. So there was some good that did come out of that. That's the positive
successful
aspect of it. That's the positive aspect, where on the other hand, for those children who did not function well under the control group, there is also a downside to that as well. And if you knew anything about the AIMS study, when they went to study the African children in Africa, their developmental stages and growth were quite consistent up until they went to school. And when they went to school, they started finding that the child would become retarded, mm-hmm. and their growth started to decline. So these are all studies that I have in my new book that I've done over 5 years. And true enough, that non-traditional programs that, you know, the child needs to socialize and needs to be home and needs to be with mother during that age. There's a lot of countries that do put their children in these traditional programs starting at 3-year-old. But what happens with America is a little different. I find that you're trying to indoctrinate a child to a certain routine, and if they are not, if they do not have the age that is, where they're able to socialize, then mothers are finding that they put them in the classroom to help them socialize. So there's a positive pole here and a negative, and that has not been determined as to if it's to their benefit to be in school. Because at the same time, they're finding that those children did go on to college and they did graduate. Now, is that a good thing or a bad thing for blacks? That's what we should be asking.
It's the system that produces either a docile student slash citizen or a hostile student slash citizen. It doesn't become a good or a bad. It becomes hostile or docile. You either are cooperative without question, and you contribute to the exact same systematic run-of-the-mill that is currently going on.
You have to give me some statistics on that because, see, that's a general opinion.
Well, one of the things that I was going to share with you, is Indiana is one of 41 states that determines the number of jail cells based on first-grade reading scores. We're in Indiana. So this is one of those states. It's considered a police state. At one time, Indiana was considered like the number one state, and this was back when, I believe you told me you're here in Indiana, right? You're not in the same city with me, but you are in Indiana.
Yeah, I'm in Indiana. I'm here in
Okay.
Indiana.
Good deal. So at one time, you may remember Stephen Goldsmith, what was his name? Goldsmith.
Stephen Goldstein, a Jewish gentleman who wrote a book you're talking about?
He was awarded, he received high accolades for his ability to keep the statistics under control and balance when it came to being a,
Was that under the bell curve?
No. The thing is, for Indiana, like many states in the United States, our judicial system and our educational system are very snug. They have a very snug relationship. And you'll find the very statistics you share with us about special ed students coincide with the statistics about children who begin being processed in our juvenile systems here.
Well, let me say this. You're not talking to somebody who's not familiar with that, and you're absolutely
exactly right.
I pulled some statistics that show that literally all the special ed children who went to special ed and were labeled and were processed as special ed, a large number of those children ended up in the penal institution, and these
exactly.
were teachers who explained this because they were part of the school system and they saw them once they transferred over into the penal institution, some of those same children were targeted to go there. And that's absolutely true.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is...
And you also know that some of them, as you stated, are ill-assessed. In all actuality, some of them don't actually belong in special ed. A lot of children who are in special ed don't belong.
And you know what, Sister Latavia, the system is broken. I was in early intervention where you saw the child when he first came to school, and we were required to assess and make referrals. What I had found was there's a maturation stage of a young child, and most of what you're looking at could be a maturation problem, meaning that they're socially not there, but it's not an academic problem, but it just is a growth problem because they haven't matured yet. And a large portion of the children I refused to put a label on. I refused to refer. And I kept those children for 3 years in something what you call a looping. So that way I could see the growth of that child before I made the mistake of labeling that child and damaging them for life. And I caution most teachers to do that because being a child development specialist, I knew that over the summer that child's maturation could actually speed up and develop and grow. However, what we were finding is that because they were able to get these children supposedly in early intervention, get them into a specialist classroom, one of the things that they promised us that they would get the remediation, and by the time they transitioned to go to kindergarten, that they would have no label, they would go into regular kindergarten. Now, most of us teachers stood behind that to make sure that happened, because we definitely didn't want to be a part of a conspiracy where we were helping to label these babies that were coming in, and I refused to put a label on if I didn't see that child transitioning into regular ed. Now, granted, there are some children that were crack cocaine children who could not completely be remediated without special ed. Now, by and large, we definitely pushed to get services for those children so that they could have proper education. But my question is, what is proper special ed? And does special ed remediate? And now, we're also talking about relationships. Let me, don't forget this whole topic is about female-male relationship. Let me say that there's a big problem automatically when we teach the male child, specifically the black male child, is literally given less time to respond. And this is something I found out through my research. We have literally created a biased behavior in the classroom with the female child opposed to the male. The male is not taught. He's literally coached along, and literally he's assumed to not to know anything, whereas the girl is literally taught directly too. And I discovered that there was a lot of biases that female teachers held towards the males in the class. And in my 2 years of studying the black males in the classroom, I found that by the time they turned went to fourth grade, they start failing substantially. Even though these were the children that excelled beyond prior to fourth grade, these children begin to start experiencing a more hostile curriculum, a curriculum that, because dealing with logical things is very aggressive. It became very aggressive opposed to a curriculum being very user-friendly when they were, you know, in first through kindergarten through third grade. And the parents started to complain, how is my child starting to fail now, and he has been an A and B student up until now? And the parents can't, and the teachers can't explain it, but I normally would tell the parent, they changed the curriculum. And the curriculum is a little bit more aggressive, and it is not user-friendly, and we're going to have to make this child a whole-brain learner. Now, what can you tell me about relationships of male and female in the classroom, and have you noticed anything that might be going on when it comes to teaching a male or opposed to teaching a female in the classroom?
Well, my experience has been, and I've had it both ways, I've had classrooms where we had, they were segregated. We've had all male, all female classes, and we've had integrated classes.
Okay. Now, we also was talking about the role of culture and the dimensions of consciousness, and I had five things that I wanted to look at. What are the five dimensions of consciousness? And when we say conscious-based education, a lot of New Age people think we are talking about just meditation, but we're literally talking about understanding rites of passage and their history. And then I also asked, what are the three dimensions of culture? And to my knowledge, that children are taught, oh, you have a heritage. And most of the children think that that little heritage is that once a month, February, and that's all you have in the curriculum. But I always tell parents that they must insist that the child has a culture and that we brought civilization into being for all the world. And if we brought civilization into being for all the world, then we must be situated in every part of the country, and there is a presence of African-American history and culture. So we have to treat the school year the same way. We can no longer let the district get away with just incorporating 1 month out of the year for our children to learn about African Americans. Do you understand what I'm saying? Are you there? Are you there? Hello? Hello?
Who's the author?
Hello? Hello? Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes.
Sister Vatay, okay, I was trying to get you to respond. I popped her off the screen. What I was asking
yes.
is about the roles of culture in the five dimensions of consciousness. And what African Americans consider this conscious-based information. And I was saying that it's important that parents not let the school district get away with just having a heritage of Black History Month, that it's
right.
important that they teach this child that if you go around the world, there's a presence of Africans all over the world, and that we brought civilization into being. So quite naturally, being the mothers and fathers of civilization, there should be a viewpoint of history where we're showing up everywhere. In the curriculum.
Exactly.
So,
because you need a curriculum that reflects, you need a curriculum that reflects the entire population of the classroom. That's
absolutely.
One of the things. And our children make up a significant portion of that classroom.
What role would you say that culture would play in the child knowing themselves? What role would you normally tell the child that their culture should play in knowing themselves and who they are?
When culture is absent from curriculum, then children are directly told that they have no culture. So culture becomes everything because it's what makes their education relevant. It's what makes the academics applicable. Otherwise, they lose interest because just as you did with the experiment in the micro school, it has nothing to do with their reality. It does not apply to them. And you'll find
middle school, they start saying,
when will I ever use this skill? What does this have to do with me? How is this relevant to my life? And that's when you're experiencing those first feedback signs that you're losing this kid, you're losing this child. And that is exactly a direct product of this system. It is designed to produce some that will become docile, some that will become hostile.
And, you know, Sister Latavia, it would be very hard to convince most of the parents of what you're saying, and the reason why I say that is because they may have had a few success stories, but they're not looking at the overall picture of the damage, and a lot of our children have made it through with success and have made it through by being docile and following the status quo, and then our parents mistakenly say, oh, well, Junior did so well. He was never in trouble. He never went to the principal, and he was always on the honor roll. That's because he became that docile character that you're talking about. And sometimes we have to buck and scratch where we don't itch and become docile in order to go along, to get along. And those are the children that are not usually designed to become independent leaders. You have to go back and reiterate to them that they are leaders and show them how to take a leadership role because they have, and they very well have become docile. Just like you said. Now, what I'd like to say for the listening audience, as a teacher, and I don't care who wants to challenge me on this, because I stand behind what I say in this room, and I have no reason to lie. There's too many children that are looking to the African-American teachers to make things better, to correct things, and sometimes we look at them with a jaundiced eye, like, man, I got to save myself. But we got to be heroes to these children. We got to step up, say things that are wrong, and we got to make the changes. Sometimes we have to get out of the situation, get out of the school system, and get on the outside to go in to make the changes. Sister Latavia, I was brought in several times to be a specialist to fix broken problems, where I was brought in to teach an African-centered classroom where I was told I could not teach slavery, only the dynasty of the ancient dynasty. And I wasn't quite sure why, but I was told that every teacher had quit that taught these children social studies. So I then began to administer the African dynasty and the Egyptian mythology and teaching the children from that perspective. I saw a whole different group of children. I administered all A's and B's to them when I first told them. And these children all performed to the level of the occasion just because they were taught their history. And in doing the research I was doing with black boys, I found that the black boys had a problem when women in the classroom did not be consistent with them and were not honest with them and just allowed them to just slide through, never doing their work, just giving them the grades for just being there because they were so in love with the boys and they thought that it would be easier just to let the boys slide through. And hopefully my research will be coming out pretty soon on the effects that females have on African-American males coupled with their culture. And I'd like to say, Sister Batavia, that we African-Americans have to get in on this thing, and we need to have study groups and look at what can we do when we come back the following next school year to make a difference in the administration. We are sitting in these classrooms collecting a check, knowing that things are wrong. We will not speak up. We won't say anything. And those that do speak up, they try to ostracize them. They try to penalize them. But you have to be a bit of a hero to be an African-American in the classroom these days. You have to be a bit of a hero, and you have to go and speak your mind. And when something is not right, you cannot be a part of the conspiracy. And my very book that I'm writing is on Dr. Zawanza Jufu, who talked about the conspiracy. And he asked, who is the conspirator? I answered back and said, us females are the conspirator, and we're carrying out this masquerade in the classroom. And we're not asking any questions, and we know that some of the things are wrong, and we're carrying them out anyway, and we're getting all these awards for being a passive teacher to follow along, but at the same time, we could change some things in the classroom by putting our foot down, saying, this isn't right, that isn't right, this needs to be changed. Now, I'm cautioning all teachers, don't throw caution to the wind. This year, when you start out the school year, if there needs to be things changed from last year, by God, put your foot down and make the change, because you're giving our children a ticket up the road, sending them straight into the penal institution without knowing, I think, or maybe intentionally, but you're not letting these parents know that they don't have to sign their children over to special ed. There are alternatives to drug therapy, and they can get help for their children. Sometimes you're more of the problem than the administration. If you're not going to leave, get out the way. But you must certainly step up. Talk to these parents. Allow these parents to come in your class to help their own children. Put an apron on your parents. Make them a part of the solution in correcting the problem. But you certainly cannot go on with this masquerade anymore, perpetrating a classroom setting. It cannot continue to happen. Curriculums must change. And I say that, Sister Latavia, because I'm sincere in what I'm saying. Sometimes you get sick and tired of being sick and tired. Like saying that Fanny says that you just get sick and tired. And I look at each school year and see the children struggling and failing and struggling and us testing and testing. There are programs you can give children to make their self-esteem go up. And Dr. Zawanza Jufu has a set clip program that he can turn grades around just by improving the child's self-esteem. If the child loves you, he can even perform better for you. He will push himself to levels that he don't even have the capability of. But we as teachers have got to understand part of what is going on is really our fault, too, because we're carrying out this mission statement, teachers. Now, I know this because I've researched it, and I took a sabbatical and left the system so I could write about it, to talk about solutions instead of passing up the problem. Now, Sister Batavia has come along to give us some insight about what she feels that homeschoolers should be doing. On the last note, Sister Batavia, do you have any recommendation for those homeschoolers and what they could be doing and the ones that are contemplating homeschooling? Can you give us any recommendations?
Yes, you'll have to customize all academics to each individual student's learning style and personality and interests. It's an exhausting task, but just keep your benchmarks in mind and make sure that you're using learning styles, interests, and personalities when you're formulating how to convey and help that child grasp the concepts you need them to learn. Unfortunately, I scheduled myself for another appointment after this. I know your show is ending.
Well, thank you. Thank you so very much, Sister Latavia. And we want to thank Sister Latavia for being a part of our show. And once again, teachers, don't hesitate to call into the show. I'll be willing to talk to you. I am a master teacher, not only of the traditional education in the elementary, but also Montessori, and I'm now studying the Rudolf Steiner's concept. We need to look at other methodologies and concepts when ours have failed. And we also need to take a look internally of what we could do different about incorporating an African-centric curriculum. And that needs to be done like yesterday, teachers. We don't have time to waste. We are losing children. We are losing the momentum of the parents. And what I'm gathering around me now are parents. So in and with I ever have to help a parent, believe you me, I am going to help those parents because I am an advocate. And I've been an advocate all my life. And parents, please know that you must become a self-advocate for your special ed children. Teachers, you are going to have to become the child's first advocate. Don't throw that child into special ed until you've done proper assessment, until you've had a chance to determine if it's a maturation problem or if it's a problem that it's a health condition. Parents, you have to also be a present parent. Come to school with your child. Be a part of that child's life. And technically, statistically speaking, most of these African-American boys are making up the larger numbers of our special needs. That is almost impossible to believe that all African-American males are ignorant and that they can't learn. It has to be a mistake somewhere in the statistics. Because I graduated an all-honored scholar student with a 3.0 all the way through school, high honors, and graduated with honors. So I know that those statistics are wrong. Somewhere along the line, we've got some genius men that are out there, and mothers and teachers, we must find them. We must make them into genius. And if you don't know how, you can call Omi and tell them that Omi said call her, and I'll tell you what to put in a curriculum for a black male to keep him energetic and excited about learning. Don't take the lights and turn them off on the black children. They're our last hope. And we've got to show genius in our children. And we've got to induce the knowledge that was already placed there from birth. It is nothing that we're giving them. They were brought here on this earth with the knowledge. You can't teach a child anything if you wanted to. All you can do is pull out what's already there. Now get behind me as an advocate and come on and let's pull out the positive things that are in our children. Let's induce the knowledge. Let's go to the school board meeting. Let's go to the classroom teachers and let's be an advocate like we should be. I want to say one thing to the teachers that might find it strange or might think that I'm talking against the teachers. No, I'm not. I am first for what is right, and I am standing up for what is right. As an advocate, I know for so long somebody has turned the other cheek and looked the other way when they knew that things could be done differently in the classroom. Now, I implore you, teachers, you've got to make a difference. You are a part of the conspiracy, unbeknown to you or not. You have got to open up and point out and indicate when things are not right. And you have got to look into curriculums that are more suited for African-American children. And I want to say that I know that you know what a child needs if you're raising an African-American child yourself. Whatever your child needs at home that you're raising, it's the same thing that the children in the classroom need. And remember that Omi told you so. Omi said, let your light shine on the world. You tell those children, when you look them in the eye, let your light shine on the world. And they will do just that. And I want to welcome you, and I want to also consider you being a part of the solution and not a part of the problem. We are awake these days, and we are conscious. If you need a little bit more consciousness and need to learn how to do it, come in this classroom and we'll teach you how to be more conscious about how to implement African-centristic curriculum in the classroom for the child. Yes, we have an Eurocentric self-esteem, white male self-esteem curriculum that we've been using unbeknown to us. Now that you know it, it's time to do something to make the changes. Make that change today, as Michael Jackson would say. Make that change. make that change. And I'll see you on Monday, bright and early at 6 o'clock. Come with your question. That number is 646-478-0270. Have a great day, and oh, double.